getting to wear out, but we do ask you to indeed give your attention to our speaker. Again, we welcome you to the 2023 Mid-Atlantic Christadelphian Bible School, and the first teacher this morning is our brother Roger Lewis of the Christ Church New Zealand Ecclesia. His subject for the week, Secret of Sound Spiritual Reasoning, in today's class, How to Serve in the Ecclesia with Spiritual Commitment. Brother Roger.
Well, good morning, everyone. On this fine and sunny day. Now, this morning, as Brother Bob has mentioned, we're going to move our attention from our own lives, perhaps finding a partner in the truth, and thinking out now beyond ourselves to the matter of ecclesial life. And so the title here, How to Serve in the Ecclesia with Spiritual Commitment, is, I suppose, really about coming to understanding the role of ecclesial life and our part, our contribution that we might make in that regard. So here's the reality. When a person's baptized, we actually join the company of the saints. Can anyone tell me what happens in your ecclesia when a baptism occurs? What's the actual like sequence of events? When do baptisms mostly occur in your meeting, by the way? Is there a day of the week they normally happen? Any takers on that? Yes? So it could be Friday or the weekend. So anyone here have baptisms in their ecclesia on a Sunday morning? So some on a Sunday morning, quite often on a Saturday, maybe, you're quite right. So, but in addition to the baptism, is there anything else that happens that weekend? What else happens besides the baptism? Any thoughts on that? So when a person's baptized, you'll attend, they're baptized, they come out of the waters, there might be a talk given, there could be a supper or a meal to follow or something, and that's one part, but then what else happens as part of a person being baptized and coming into the meeting? Yes. The right hand of fellowship. Now that's an interesting expression because it's entirely right. It's also biblical. Does anyone know where that comes from? The right hand of fellowship. Anyone know where that phrase comes from? So in other words, it's not just a word. It sounds like, oh, we give you the right hand of fellowship. Well, yeah, but it's actually not a Christadelphian term. It's a biblical one. Now, where does it come from? Any thoughts? I'll give you a clue. It was about a moment when someone was in Jerusalem, and the ones in Jerusalem decided to give this man the right hand of fellowship. Now, who was the man that they gave the right hand of fellowship to? It's in Galatians. Come and have a look at Galatians, because maybe that's a helpful thing to begin with, is to realize that much of what we do in our community isn't just because, oh, well, that's what Christadelphians do. No, Christadelphians do what Christadelphians do because the Bible says that's what we should do. It's actually scriptural and biblical. So we're told in Galatians 2, reading from verse 7, it says, but contrariwise, when they saw that the gospel of the uncircumcision was committed unto me, as the gospel of the circumcision was unto Peter, for he that wrought effectually in Peter to the apostleship of the circumcision, the same was mighty in me towards the Gentiles. And when James and Cephas and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given unto me, they gave to me and Barnabas the right hands of fellowship, that we should go unto the heathen and they unto the circumcision. So they gave them the right hand of fellowship. And that term has been taken by us for the expression we use when a newly baptized brother or sister is going to be inducted into the truth, into an ecclesia. So the thing to remember when a person's baptized is that really two things are happening to them. They're going to be, Well, does anyone know what's said at that receiving into fellowship? Can anyone remember any of the words or language that you've heard when a person's received into fellowship, inverted commas? What does the presiding brother or the chairman say? Anyone know roughly what the words are? The chairman normally says something like, on behalf of your brothers and sisters here in this ecclesia, and on behalf of, now what else does he say? Have you never been to a baptism before? Who's been to a baptism? Right, who's listened to what's said? So have a crack at giving me an answer. What do they say? Remember at my very first session I talked about paying attention in life? If you don't pay attention to anything, you don't see anything, you don't notice anything. So what's said is important. So what do they say? I think there was a hand up, sorry. Was it yours? Yep. Yes. Now, that's good. On behalf of the ecclesia, like the whole of the world, can I rephrase that for you? But you're right. So what's generally said is, on behalf of the brothers and sisters of this ecclesia here, because they're going to join that meeting, they're going to be enrolled as members of that meeting, but then the chairman says, and on behalf of all those who meet worldwide on the basis of the Birmingham Amended Statement of Faith, we welcome you into the brotherhood. We extend to you now the right hand of fellowship. And so why that's significant is that that brother's not just giving the new baptized person the right hand of fellowship to join Norfolk Ecclesia or Book Road Ecclesia. They're going to be enrolled as a member of that ecclesia. But the group they've joined is the worldwide community of the brothers and sisters everywhere. That's the group they've joined. But you join it by means of entering in through one ecclesia. So you can't be a member of the worldwide community but not be a member of an ecclesia. Well, generally that's the case because your association with the truth is generally via an ecclesial body or community. So even someone that was living in isolation would tend to go to an ecclesia and be baptized there by them and then be received into fellowship. So we join that community. Do you know why? Because even though we call it the Birmingham, the people meeting on the basis of the Birmingham Amended Statement of Faith, that's really another way of describing the seed of the woman community, the blue line community. You're joining the blue line community, and we're officially welcoming you into that community on this day. So the right hand of fellowship is deeply symbolic. So we don't give you the hug. It's the right hand of fellowship. It's the hand of greeting between friend to friend, brother to brother, sister to sister. And that's a very special moment in all of our lives when baptism occurs. And why this is important is because it reminds us that you're not being baptized to simply be an individual in your life. I've decided to get baptized, so yeah, but actually you have decided to get baptized, and that's excellent because it must be an individual decision. But now you're going to be inducted into a whole community of people, not just you. You will not be able to live your life as just me. Me and my God. No, that is not how you will live your life in the truth. Because me and my God is essentially, intrinsically selfish. And so the whole purpose of the truth is to bind us into a community that we belong to so that we might think beyond ourselves to the wider implications of working and contributing to a community even though we have our individual faith. And I believe that at the day of the judgment seat, we won't just be held to account for what we've done in our own life. We'll also be held to account for what we've done for the community of Christ. Or what we haven't done for the community of Christ. Because that's what we're joining. We're joining the household of faith. So let's have a look at that scripturally to start with in terms of the importance of the ecclesia. And actually, it's rather wonderful what the scriptures say, because the scriptures talk about the ecclesia in a variety of different ways, all of which are true, but which perhaps lead to different lessons and different implications. For example, there's a set of passages here, Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4, that all talk about the ecclesia as a body. So it's sort of like obviously using a type. The ecclesia is like a body that needs to be looked after, a body that can grow. So all of those passages are relevant in that regard. But then there's a set of scriptures that talk about the ecclesia as a house. So Ephesians 2 and 1 Timothy 3 and 1 Peter 2 talks about the ecclesial house. So it's a different theme, a different idea. And then there's another set of passages that talks about the ecclesia as a city. And lastly, I've got here a set of passages that talk about the ecclesia as a bride. So here are four different ways of understanding what the ecclesia is like and what the ecclesia is about. Well, it's like a body. It's like being part of a body. It's like being part of a house. It's like belonging to a city. It's like being part of a bride. Now, why would you think that the scriptures would present the idea of an ecclesia in different ways like that? Any thoughts? Yeah. That's right. The different ways of expressing the same essential idea, is that what you're saying? That a building has got to have like doors and windows and corridors and bedrooms and everything needs to function in order for the house to function. All the parts of the house have to function, and clearly that's the same with a body. And what about a city? Actually, pretty much the same for the city. A city's got to have gates. A city's got to have shops. A city's got to have streets. A city's got to have people that actually manage the city. There's all sorts of implications for the governance and administration of a city. Absolutely right. And as a bride, well, there are various themes that might emerge from the idea of a bride. So actually, I think what Scripture's trying to do is to enrich our viewpoint here, to see that the ecclesia is a variety of different things, and that each of those is a possible way in which we might be able to contribute to ecclesial life. So let's revisit this now and think about what they might teach. So, you see, I think that the ecclesia as a body illustrates the importance of good nourishment and sound growth. That's what a body needs. So where's the matters of good nourishment in an ecclesia? Tell me what you think the areas of good nourishment are. Yeah. Sunday school. Correct. Anything else? Yes. Study classes for the members, so Bible class, yes. Bible school would be a good illustration, yes. Anything else? Yes. Memorial service would be part of it. Do you call youth activities here CYC? Is that the same word in the Americas as it is elsewhere? So CYC activities. So in all of those things, whether it's Sunday school or CYC or Bible class or the memorial meeting or maybe even public lectures, actually, incidentally, hands up who have public lectures in their ecclesias? No public lectures? Sunday by Sunday? You do? You have Tuesday once a month. Okay, so but you do have public lectures. Hands up those who've got seminars running. Okay, so there's a bit of a gap in the story here in terms of preaching the truth. So Brother Robert says in the Ecclesial Guide that an ecclesia to be balanced needs to focus on internal growth, which is Bible class, and preaching to those without, and that the ecclesia needs a balance of both those activities. Why do you think that would be important? Why should half of our work be preaching without? Yes? Yes, well, numerically, you mean you could grow by preaching, we add to the numbers. But also it's a sense of focus. You see, even an ecclesia could say, oh, let's all get together and let's grow ourselves. Let's grow ourselves. Forget about everyone else. Let's grow ourselves. And you can become so focused on your ecclesia that the rest of the world doesn't matter. So you could become very inward focused about just your meeting. So to preach to others is to widen your perspective back out to the other side of your responsibilities. It's a case of mindset, really. So an ecclesia that has really good Bible classes and really good public lectures, now that's a good combination, because you've got those two sides of nourishing within, but also of preaching without. So what we've just seen is that there are specific activities in ecclesial life that help to nourish the body with sound growth. And if an ecclesia does have a really good Bible class with excellent studies and stirring lectures and a great CYC and Sunday school that's absolutely thriving, then that ecclesia will grow. That body will grow because it's being nourished. And if those things are not present and not happening, well, that's the responsibility of arranging brethren to say, well, what do we need to do? What can we do to make those aspects of our ecclesial life better? Because we're not growing. And that's part of the challenge of ecclesial life, is how to face those issues and do the best you can. So what's interesting about that is just simply saying, oh yes, we have a Bible class, tick. Having Bible class may not cut the mustard. The question is, do you have a Bible class that's sufficiently interesting and stimulating so that people are growing spiritually, so that the body's being nourished? Have you got that Bible class? And if you haven't got that Bible class, what are we going to do about it? So this is part of growing the body. But remember, we said that in addition to that, there's also these references that talk about the ecclesia as a house. And a house illustrates the importance of careful building and wise conduct. So if you're to think about things now that relate to the careful building of the ecclesial house, what aspects spring to mind within an ecclesia that relate to building the house? Any thoughts? Slightly different to nourishing a body. How do you build a house, by the way? What's a very good way to build a house? Yes? Start with the foundations. It's an excellent idea. It's very difficult to start with the windows. But you see, the foundations become crucial, because what do the foundations do? They first of all make sure that the building is level. You do not want, ideally, a house where your bedroom on the top floor has got problems because the foundations weren't level. So how do we level the foundations? Well, we make sure that all the things that relate to the foundations of spiritual life are level and established. What might that be? Can you think of what the foundations might be of the ecclesial house then? How do we build level foundations? Yes. Christ. Now, be more specific. Yes? Right? So how would we follow his example? Now we're getting warmer. So do you know there's a good phrase that you could think of that attaches to that? There's a set of references that talk about the commandments of Christ. So Old Testament talks about the commandments of God, but the New Testament mentions the commandments of Christ, the commandments of Christ. So how do we follow Christ? Answer: by learning his commandments and following those, because that's much more specific, isn't it? If we say we're going to follow Christ, well, what does that mean? That's too general. So one of the key things about focusing attention, you must always get down to the concrete, to the granular, to the detailed. How do we follow Christ? Answer: by following his commandments. Well, where are those? Well, you need to find them, but they're there. Incidentally, in the Christadelphian statement of faith, we have three sections. Anyone know what the three sections are in the Christadelphian statement of faith? Because I'd say this is the foundations of the house. Anyone know what the three sections of the statement of faith are? Yes? Doctrine to be rejected is correct. It's the second one. So if that's negative, what would be positive that comes before that? Yes? Yep. So the Birmingham End Statement of Faith is the heading for the whole thing, but the three sections are truths to be received, positive, doctrines to be rejected, negative, and incidentally, did you know that that's entirely biblical? Because in the Old Testament, there was a statement of faith in the days of Moses, and it had things that they had to do and things that they were not allowed to do, positive and negative. I believe that the apostles had a statement of faith. And as part of their statement of faith, there were things that they were supposed to do and things that they were not supposed to do, positive and negative. So when we come to the Birmingham amended statement of faith and it's got truths to be received, positive, and doctrines to be rejected, negative, did you realize that's based on Scripture? That itself is scriptural. And then the last section of our statement of faith is the commandments of Christ. So if you want to know what the commandments of Christ are, to follow and to listen and to learn and to obey, they're in the statement of faith. In fact, guess what? 52 of them. 52, what a convenient number. So in other words, you could follow a commandment of Christ every week. And a great way of learning the commandments of Christ, because these are the foundations of ecclesial life, is you could write one out and put it on your mirror. So that when you come to the mirror to beautify yourself in the mornings, actually what you see in front of you is the beauty of Christ. And you read that commandment on the mirror as you're preparing yourself for the day. And you think about actually what you should really be focusing on. Am I focusing on me or am I focusing on him? You could put one of those in your bedroom door so that as you walk out the door from your bedroom every day, just before the day starts, the commandment of Christ is there looking at you. If you did that every week for a year, you would have had contact with all the commandments of Christ. That would be extremely helpful. That would be part of building a good house. Now imagine that every other brother and sister in the meeting did the same thing as that. And now the whole ecclesia knows the commandments of Christ and are trying to walk in them. You've just built a house with good foundations. So having clarity on those doctrines, both the doctrines to be received and the ones to be rejected and the commandments of Christ, that's how you build a good house. Strong foundations. Always start with foundations was the wise advice. Absolutely true. The funny thing is that when you get the foundations right, buildings seem to work. The doors fit, the windows fit, the roof fits, the bedrooms work, everything works because the foundations are right. Building houses. Can I tell you something? Building an ecclesial house isn't easy. None of that happens by accident. It happens because people work hard in the truth to guard all of that and to make sure that the house is built properly. Every ecclesia needs people who can help build their house. And if you've got people in your ecclesia who are busy building the house, are you thankful for those people? Do you appreciate the work they do to lay those foundations? You should be. You're living in the house, or you will be. And then there is that section we talked about, which is the ecclesia as a city. And I think that what that does is it illustrates the importance of faithful guarding and communal joy. Because you see, the thing about the city was, every night, what happened to a city every night? Something happened. The close of every day. Did you have your hand up? They did. They closed the gates. They closed the gates. Why would that be helpful? Yes? Now you can sleep in peace. Everyone could sleep in peace because there's no one getting in that night because the gates are shut. Absolutely. So there is a sense here of guarding those within. So what do you think there would be in ecclesial life that guards the community? Any thoughts on that? What could we take up that's involved with matters of guardianship? Well, again, you can think of several things, but one of the things I believe that would be correct in ecclesial life is that the ecclesia's got certain processes and protocols, certain arrangements that they follow, and that guards the integrity of the community down through time. Every ecclesia has its rules. And, you know, rules are a funny thing because people look at rules and think, rules? Who wants rules? Well, the Bible's full of rules. God has rules. Rules are good, by the way, provided you understand the rule. But ecclesias need to be guided with certain rules that guard how that ecclesia functions. So do we have sort of like an unwritten rule that we have a meeting on Sunday mornings for the breaking of bread? Yes. Is that biblically based? Anyone? Should we meet every Sunday for the breaking of bread? Where would we get that from? Any thoughts? Where's that from? Proof. Give me biblical evidence. Mere assertion. Ooh, I can see it on the tip of your tongue. Is it hanging there? Actually, there was, let me give you a clue. I can think of a passage where a young man fell out the window because the talk was too long. Now, where's that? Eutychus was the quintessential teenager. He'd stayed up too late the previous night and fell asleep in the middle of Paul's address. It was hot upstairs. Too many lights in the room, the record says. So he fell asleep and tipped out back through the window. And they thought he'd died. Just as well the Apostle Paul was there, because the Apostle Paul came downstairs, embraced him, and revived him. Do you think Eutychus would have ever fallen asleep in a Bible class again? Probably not after that. But where is that? Are you in the Acts of the Apostles? Excellent, that's a good sign. Acts 20, try Acts 20. So see if you can find a passage in Acts 20 that might confirm to us that we have a rule for the regularity of the breaking of bread. Yes. Okay, got it. So verse 7. So on the first day of the week, what day of the week is that? Sunday. Still, is it Sunday on the first day of the week? Here in America as well as New Zealand? There's two, yes. It's Sunday. So that's what the apostles did. They established a rule. Now, incidentally, that rule was linked to what the Jews did in previous times, because they broke bread on what day of the week? When did the Jews have their celebration? On the seventh day of the week, on the Sabbath. So what do you think the significance was of the apostles having the breaking of bread on the first day of the week? Any thoughts? Why do you think that day was significant? Why on the first day of the week? Well, clearly it was sort of partly to distinguish them from the Jews, not the seventh day, but why the first day? Why not the third? Yes. Ooh, the first thing that comes to your mind on the first day of the week. Except that's true, but you know, for people in those days, every day was the same. They probably, many of them were slaves, and so every day was the same. They were a slave every day. But think about the first day of the week. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. How could you also describe the first day of the week? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yes, but try it again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. What's 8 symbolize? Scripturally, what does 8 symbolize? Anyone know? It's the symbol of the resurrection. It's the resurrection number. So can you imagine why that might have been a fantastic day for the brothers and sisters to break bread? It celebrated the resurrection of Christ. It distinguished them from the Jews who met on the seventh day, and so the disciples met on the eighth day. Oh yes, it was the first day of the week, but it was also the eighth day. And it had its own special associations, therefore, with the death and resurrection of Christ. So we're here to guard certain things. So here's my point with regard to that. Having the breaking of bread on a day of the week is a biblical rule, if you can put it that way. But it's a rule we gladly follow, because we want to follow. Rules only have to be bad if you want them to be bad. You can look at a rule and either say, oh, this is something I must comply with as a law, or you can look at a rule and say, this enshrines a divine principle which I want to uphold in my life, because it's God's principle. You can look at the same thing two different ways. It's your mindset to choose. So guarding the things in ecclesial life is how a city functions. You want a city to work? You need to guard it, both from within and from without. And then lastly, remember it says that the ecclesia was a bride. And that illustrates the importance of loving preparation and holy living. That this ecclesia is actually getting ready for Christ. So if our lives are getting ready for Christ, then how should we live? What do you think we should do to get ready for Christ? How do we prepare? How do we live holy lives as someone that's waiting for him to come? Now, don't you think that's interesting, is that the scriptures, therefore, present the idea of the ecclesia in those different ways to stress that there are different aspects of ecclesial life that we ought to treasure, that we ought to value, and that we ought to participate in. Now, here's another thought. Do you know that the ecclesia is the official unit of fellowship? What do you think I mean when I say unit of fellowship? Any thoughts on that? The ecclesia is the official unit of fellowship. Actually, the word official is not good. The ecclesia is the biblical unit of fellowship. What would unit mean in this context? Any thoughts? Unit of fellowship. Yes. The what? Yes, it's like, can you think of two ecclesias that are close by in your area? What ecclesias would you have where two ecclesias are quite close to each other physically? You could drive from one to the other in a reasonably short time. You know, and think of two ecclesias like that in your area? What ecclesia are you in? How near is the nearest ecclesia? How long? An hour. So let's say it was an hour. You can speed if you like, but let's say it was an hour. Here's the point. Those two ecclesias are sort of, you know, like close enough to one another. But here's the thing, that each of those ecclesias are scripturally a unit by themselves. They function like a whole cosmos or world within themselves. They talk to each other, but your ecclesia doesn't tell that ecclesia what to do, even though they're only an hour away. They run their own ecclesia. You don't run it for them. And conversely, they can't tell your ecclesia what to do because they're like a unit of fellowship in themselves. Now, there was something wise about that because, you see, notice what it says. Acts 15, they ordained elders in every ecclesia. Each ecclesia was like a little flock and it had its own shepherds. Acts 20, verses 17, he called for the elders of the ecclesia and said, you over which the flock over which you've been made the overseer. So they were like shepherds. Titus chapter 1, I ordain elders in every city. By the way, when it says in Titus 1, elders in every city, why would there be ecclesial elders in a city? Do you think the city would be happy to have ecclesial elders? What does that mean really, do you think? Elders in every city. Why would there be arranging brethren in a city? Any thoughts on that? Yes. Yes, it could be, but I think on this occasion it's because in most cities there was an ecclesia. So I come from Christchurch, and so because I'm from Christchurch, there is an ecclesia called Christchurch. So it's the name of the city, but it's actually the elders were ordained not for that city in terms of a worldly city, but for the ecclesia in that city that bears the same name. So, and in fact, what happened in my city is we started with what was called the Christchurch Bible Hall Ecclesia, and that was started in 1890 because of a visit from Robert Roberts. And then it grew, and then we had Christchurch Suburban Ecclesia, and then the suburban ecclesia that I'm part of grew, and then we decided to divide it into two meetings, and that was Christchurch North and Christchurch West. And so suddenly you've got Christchurch Bible Hall Ecclesia, Christchurch North Ecclesia, Christchurch West Ecclesia, and then we've got Christchurch Parkins Ecclesia, and Christchurch. Yeah. And so now we've got five ecclesias, but they're all Christchurch ecclesias. They're in that city. But the elders that were being ordained in every city by Titus were cities in Crete where there was a meeting in that town. And of course, the elders weren't being ordained as elders of that whole city, but they were being ordained as the elders of the ecclesia in that city that bore that name. So hands up here who are in an ecclesia that actually bears the name of their city. I do, Christchurch. Oh, I'm Christchurch North. Who else is in an ecclesia that's actually, what ecclesia are you from? So Moorestown is a city or a town, or at least. So anyone else? So is everyone else in ecclesias that, so is Echo Lake an area? Yeah, yeah. So it's maybe not big enough to qualify as a city, or it is. But it could be a town, yes. But the ecclesia bears the name of that town, which was sort of logical, really, because that's how you identify where ecclesias were. So for most of the world, ecclesias often have connection with their city names. And then lastly, the first of Peter chapter 5, the elders which are among you, I ask to feed the flock of God. So they were really like shepherds, shepherds of the flock. But the point is that Christ's flock is actually worldwide. But you can't belong to a worldwide flock in any meaningful way. So what happens is God puts each of us in one little flock, and that's got the shepherds of that flock, and he asks you to actually be in that flock. And that flock is like a unit of fellowship all by itself. But it also has responsibility. That was interesting. I didn't think I'd done anything at all, actually. So it also has responsibilities to the wider flock of the whole community of Christ. Is that me? It's coming unplugged. That's disastrous. So every ecclesia is like actually a cameo of the whole body of Christ worldwide. And so in each ecclesia, in each city, all those principles of the ecclesia as a house or a bride or a body were going to be outworked in that one place. Here's what's interesting. You've been, when you're baptized, you're inducted into the worldwide community of Christ, the seed of the woman community. But the reality is, for most of your life, you'll never see most of those people. Who's got a grip on how many Christadelphians there are right now worldwide? Any thoughts on that? Yes? That's a bigger number than I've heard, but it could be possible, yes. So how many of the, what, have you got another number? 70,000. Well, let's take the midway point between 70,000 and 120. Where would we get to? Mathematicians? So let's say 90,000, 95,000. So here's the point. How many of those are you going to meet in your lifetime? Very few. Most of the brothers and sisters alive right now in the world, you'll never see them, never meet them, never know them. You hope to in the kingdom age, but right now you won't, and you can't, because it's just too big. And that's why God says, I'm going to put you into a particular ecclesia, and for most of your spiritual life, you will live your life as part of the household of faith, but just in that one place. And your service to the body of Christ worldwide will be in your home ecclesia, where God's placed you. That's not only where you belong, but that's where you will contribute, because that's a God-appointed unit of fellowship. So each ecclesia is like the worldwide flock in cameo form. And the principles of the truth can be outworked just as well in your ecclesia as it could if you were desperately trying to run around the whole world to keep in touch with everyone, which you couldn't do anyway, so you better not start. Now that perhaps brings us to our next thought, and that is, so if that's the case, and we're inducted into the worldwide body at baptism, but also into, so remember I talked about the fact that you're enrolled as a member, so you have a membership of a certain ecclesia, but you're also part of the worldwide body at the same time. But that membership that you have within an ecclesia is what brings now to you certain responsibilities. So actually, if we were to focus then on our service, I think it's helpful to think about an ecclesia from this perspective of how that service in the truth might happen. And at this point, I'm going to put this up on the screen, and then I'm going to give you just 5 minutes to sit and think about, chat in your tables about, how you think you might best contribute to this, to the ideas on this slide. So what we've got is that at the heart and soul of ecclesial life is the doctrine of God manifestation. I believe that that is the key to the truth. That's what makes the truth special. That's what distinguishes the truth from the Christian community around us. God manifestation. And if you don't get God manifestation right, incidentally, that's the foundation. If you don't get it right, the other doctrines don't make sense, including the atonement. And because other churches do not understand God manifestation, they also do not understand the atonement. They do not have a proper view on the atonement because they do not understand God manifestation. Absolutely crucial. The foundation stone. But then inside ecclesial life, I think there are things that we could describe as matters of worship. And then there's matters of witness. So remember we talked about those two things to start with. So you've got the memorial meeting on the one side and the public lecture on the other. So there's the first thing. If you're in a meeting where there's no public lecture, you might want to have a think about that. Then there's matters of learning. That's where our Bible class comes in, Sunday school, CYC. Then there's matters of service, all the other activities of ecclesial life. And then finally, there's matters of order. And so order relates to those regulations and rules that might help for the wise governance of the ecclesia. So I'll just show you this. You probably can't see this from the back, and I understand that. But this is the core values document of my ecclesia at home. So that big circle is about God manifestation. So it reminds us that that's what the truth's all about. Inside, we say, okay, that circle now is the little one at the top, God manifestation. And then underneath that, we've got each of those areas, matters of worship, matters of learning, matters of order, matters of service, and matters of witness. And under each of those, we've got objectives of what we're trying to do in each of those areas of ecclesial life. So worship, for example, is to elevate God's holiness as Christ exalted him. And learning is to understand God's mind as Christ knew him. And order is to uphold God's principles as Christ honored him. And service is to manifest God's character as Christ revealed him. And witness is to declare God's purpose as Christ proclaimed him. And then under each of those, we've got specific objectives that you want to try and achieve. And underneath that, we've got the actual activities in ecclesial life that are designed to fulfill those responsibilities. Now, why that's good is because it enables our particular ecclesia to say, okay, and you remember that comes from the slide yesterday with regard to the role of men and the role of women, is there's all these things that can now be done in ecclesial life, but we've got to think about how best we might be able to contribute to the truth service in those areas. And I believe there's something for everyone in ecclesial life if we desire to serve. So the thing with ecclesial life is it's a training ground for the kingdom. But it's also the place where God asks us to accept some responsibility, because the key thing about an ecclesia is it's not just you. It's a bunch of other people. And you're trying to help them, and they're trying to help you, and we need to contribute together for the ecclesial good in that regard. Incidentally, there's one more thing I can think of with regard to an ecclesia in terms of the ecclesia as a body, the ecclesia as a building, the ecclesia as a city. Can you think of another, type of the ecclesia as a something else? Anything else spring to mind? There's one other obvious thing that the ecclesia could be represented as. Any thoughts? And maybe it's helpful in this particular regard. We could have put up, and maybe we should have, the ecclesia as a family. In my in the adult classes, we're doing Philip the Evangelist, and yesterday we talked about the Ethiopian eunuch. Remember the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8? I think he was a very lonely man. And when he was baptized, he joined the family of God. Do you know, there's been many a person who's come into the truth from outside, and when they were baptized and received into fellowship, the chairman for the day has said, "Welcome, brother, welcome, sister. This is your family now. We are your family now." And many a lonely person has found comfort in the ecclesia because it's our new family. So the ecclesia is a family. Now, that would be another excellent one to develop, wouldn't it? What do we need to do to build families? And so now I want you to think about that for a moment in terms of, I'll just leave that on the screen, but just take a couple of minutes to think on your own piece of paper. So what areas of ability do you have, what gifts do you have, where you might be able to contribute to any one of those key areas of ecclesial activity? Can you think of three ways in which you could contribute to ecclesial life? Now remember, you don't have to share this, but what it's about is this. Do you remember the story of the ecclesia as a body? We didn't turn it up, but remember that passage that Paul has about in Corinthians when he talks about noses and ears and eyes? Remember that passage? And what he says is you can't all be a nose. Probably no one necessarily will want to be a nose. But you can't all be ears. You can't all be hands. You can't all be feet, says the apostle. No point saying, oh, I really wish it was an ear. You might be better off as a liver. But the point is, what part of the body do you think you could be? And one of the things you've got to do in life and the truth, I believe, is at some point, you've got to think honestly, like honestly, about the gifts God's given you. What gifts has God given you? And how might you now contribute that into the family of the ecclesia? So just take a couple of minutes and just think on a piece of paper. How do you think on a piece of paper? Well, you can. Just start thinking on a piece of paper about what God-given talents you've got that you might be able to contribute to the truth service. And what area would it be? Would it be in matters of worship, matters of learning, matters of order, matters of service, matters of witness? Where do you feel you've got a strength? You might remember, I don't know if you come, do you come to the evening sessions or do you have separate classes at night? Separate classes? Oh, you come to, so I did a study on Andrew earlier on. Do you remember the story on Andrew? So Andrew had this real gift of being friendly. And not everyone's got that gift. But would that make you someone suitable for gospel proclamation? Because you've got the gift of friendliness that Andrew had. What gifts have you got? Right, a couple of minutes. Just have a wee think. Imagine Christ came back and said to you, I gave you these talents. What did you do for my people? How did you use them for my people? That'd be an interesting question, wouldn't it? Okay, so look, just to close, a couple of other thoughts then that maybe finish off this thinking. I really like this idea. So man and woman bring to the ecclesia complementary skills, and it's in the blending of these together in our activities in the truth that God manifestation is seen among us. So it doesn't matter in what context we contribute to the work of the ecclesia. There is so much to do and so much we can do, but the main thing is that we do find something in which we can contribute no matter what the arena of our service is. So, and when we do that, what happens is we fulfill in matters of worship or witness or learning or service or order, or whether as brother or sister. And what the Apostle Paul says in the 1st of Timothy 3 is when all that's going on in ecclesial life, God manifestation is seen. When an ecclesia is busy in its activities and brothers and sisters are working together, God manifestation is seen in that ecclesia, says the Apostle Paul in Timothy. And that's what we want. We want our ecclesias to be buzzing with the truth, vibrant in the truth, active in the truth. But vibrant ecclesias don't come about miraculously by themselves. They come about because people are vibrant and contribute in vibrant ways to the building of the ecclesia and to the building of the one ecclesia they can make a difference in for the body of Christ as a whole, and that's the meeting they're in. These are two really interesting quotations because they're written by two different apostles, but notice how similar they are. So Romans 12 says, having gifts differing according to the grace that's given in us, or to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy, or ministry, let us wait, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation, he that giveth, let him do it with simplicity, he that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. So what the Apostle Paul says is, your gift might be different to mine. It doesn't matter. What matters, he says, is the way in which we try and use that gift that God has given us. And interestingly enough, Peter comes along and says the same thing in the 1 Peter chapter 4. As every man has received a gift, even so minister the same to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If any man speak, let him speak. If any man minister, let him do it. As of the ability which God giveth, that God in all things might be glorified. And the best gift we can give to the Ecclesia is our gift of commitment. That we're committed to the truth and committed to the Ecclesia. When Ecclesias are full of committed people, astonishing things can happen. And when an Ecclesia is full of uncommitted people, nothing happens. It's a gift to show the spirit of commitment. And ecclesias everywhere in the world desperately need committed brothers and sisters, especially young ones, who arrive with vibrancy and enthusiasm to start their work in the work of the truth and to guard what's come before them so that they can pass it safely on to the generation that comes after them. So that gift of spiritual commitment, that's the best gift we can all bring into our service in ecclesial life. And lastly, just look at these three passages and notice the key ideas. So we're one body, says Romans 12, but everyone makes a difference. We're one body, says the 1 Corinthians 12, but every man contributes. We're one body, says Ephesians 4, but every joint supplies and every part makes its contribution. The one, the individual. The group, the single. And that's what ecclesial life's all about, is every individual coming to the truth to make a difference in terms of their own contribution. How much better would ecclesias be if we all arrived and said, what can I contribute as an individual that this ecclesia might flourish in this place to the honour of God? So can I commend that thought to your attention? Because what I can promise you is this. When you live in an ecclesia that feels like it's your family, it's just the best place to be. Because it is family. It's the best family you could ever belong to. It's the family that will never desert you. It's the family that believes the same principles and values as you do. It's the family that are going on the same journey. It's the family that are enduring the same trials and troubles. It's the family facing the same distresses. It's the family knowing the same joys. But families have codes of honour that the family is loyal to the family. The family helps out the family. The family supports the family. The family stands by the family. Do you want to be part of a family? Then become part of a family. Take up your work in that family to contribute to it in whatever ecclesia might be found, so that when our Lord comes, we might join into that greater household and be thankful that he's called us to the hope of the kingdom and that time when the entire community of Christ will be gathered together in one. So here endeth the lesson.